Well, hi and welcome. This is Dave. Let's begin with a check-in. Any questions or things that have occurred to you from our last seminar or as you're anticipating this one? What kind of questions and thoughts do you have or reflections from last time? Or anybody just want to check in and say hi?
Hi, Dave. It's Ron.
Hi, David. This is
Welcome, Ron, and welcome, Cleo. That's great.
Thank you.
Ron, what time is it right now in Australia? I should have this down, I know.
that's no problem. But Dave, I have two pieces of information. The vision to be placed on...
I'm having a little bit of trouble with the reception from you, Ron. Are you having a challenge there?
This time?
I had a trouble with the reception from you. Are you having any challenge there?
No.
I can hear you now. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm must be a tick over.
No, I can't hear him either.
It's kind of cutting out, Ron. We have a bad connection. I hope you can hear me okay. Let me check in with others. Khalil, what's going on?
That's going on relative to what? Anything? Just in general?
Just in terms of what we're doing, any thoughts or questions from last seminar, things that you thought of that would be helpful to talk about?
Yeah, thanks. No, I mean, obviously, as I mentioned in an email that you and I exchanged, the stuff is very heady. It's exciting. It's dynamic. It can at times be overwhelming. I would love to have spaces in your presentation that give us a chance to sort of absorb it, digest it, maybe ask a question, get some feedback. So I loved it, but I did have a problem, as I explained to you, with the continuous nature of the information and the lack of a chance to jump in. So.
Yeah, it is definitely not an ideal format for a seminar. I much prefer a seminar with a give and take. With only 4 hours, there's so much information that I want to convey to you that I want to respect that, but also if we have a lot of discussion, I won't be able to get the material to you, so I want to save some time at the beginning and the end for discussion, and then to do it also by email follow-up so that I'll be able to deliver it all, because there's just so much that I want to convey to you, and I know that it's a lot, it's compressed, and it's just an overwhelming amount of material, which is part of why I think hopefully the annotated outline will be helpful. But yeah, if there are, because of time, if there are questions that come up, jot them down, and we'll have some time at the end as well. So thoughts or questions now from anyone
I
that?
Do.
Go ahead, please.
Hi, Dave. It's Stacy.
Stacy, welcome.
Thank you. I was going over the information. I was absorbing it from last week. I actually listened to the recording again from the first seminar just to really absorb it. And I kind of getting the understanding that confidence really plays the key in most of the neuromarketing and the influence and persuasion. My question is that, you know, some people think they're confident, but how do people, is there some way to know if the perceivability of confidence, like, will you get into that?
Yes, we will be talking about that. Confidence is a state of mind. It's something that can be regulated and determined, and we're going to spend all of Seminar 3 on master states of mind. So we'll be returning to that question and really elaborate about the various ways of regulating states of mind and determining that for peak performance, because I think the state of mind is the major success factor that we can help our clients with as mentor coaches. So I think it's a great question, and definitely we'll be doing that and applying it then in Seminar 3.
Great, thank you so much.
Yeah, good question and good point. I think an important one. Other thoughts, questions, things that would be helpful to talk about? If not, I'll move into the material, and we'll have more time at the end then, or if it might be helpful, I'll pause in the middle to see if there are questions or clarifications, and maybe break it up in that way. Okay, we're going to talk about the neuroscience of persuasion. I want to begin again with a couple of quizzes. Ohio State University studied several hundred undergraduates and asked them to rate how much they wanted and liked various pleasurable activities. Here are the options. Receiving a paycheck. What do you think they wanted the most, thought was the most favored experience that they would seek? Receiving a paycheck, seeing a best friend, engaging in sexual activity, receiving a compliment or getting a good grade, or eating a favorite food. One of these was endorsed as much as the other four combined. It's the one that's the generator of self-esteem. The other four are markers. The students valued boosts to their self-esteem as the highest, far and away, such as receiving good grades or compliments more than any of the other experiences, more than all the other four combined. Another quiz. The American Sociological Review studied the hiring practices of three elite industries, law, investment banking, and management consulting firms, to discern the primary criteria for those qualified to make the final round of interviews. So which do you think it was that more than anything else determined someone vaulting to the final round of interviews? Intellectual prestige, like where they obtained their degree, grade point average, sharing similar experiences as the interviewer, expertise in an area of position sought, or recommendations for the position. The primary factor was sharing similar experiences as the interviewer. It's the same as the way and the reason we make purchase decisions. We buy what fits our identity. Whenever there's a resonance of something that fits with our identity, whether it's an interviewer for a prestigious firm or whether it's us as purchasing something, there's a particular part of our brain that lights up when we see something we identify with, and that determines the choices that we make. So with this as a kind of précis, let's talk about persuasion now, and particularly the neuroscience of persuasion. Persuasion we can simply define as the process of getting your prospect to clearly associate a most desired feeling or state with your service or product. People by people, to connect to a person they know, like, and trust. Let me give you an example of this. When I was about 9 years old, it was time to buy a new coat for school. I went to the big city close to the farm outside the little town where I lived. We looked at coats at three or four stores. That's all there was. At one store, I really liked the salesman. He was a warm, engaging, funny guy, seemed to take a genuine interest in me. The coat I was looking at was a light blue soft velour with an elastic bottom, sort of a balloon effect. You kind of pretty much had to be there. He said, "Man, you look really good in that coat." Now, nobody had ever told me I looked good in a coat before. I knew right then that was the coat I was going to buy. I just had to convince my mom. I emphasized to my mom how much I wanted that coat. Now, I didn't particularly like the coat, but I really liked that salesman. I liked the coat even less when I got home. That salesman had done a splendid job. I could not grow out of that coat fast enough. For 3 years, every time it got cold, I had vague memories of a very nice salesman while I looked like my head was on top of a light blue marshmallow. So let's look now at the art and science of explanation first. All professionals suffer the curse of knowledge to some degree. One of the most profound aspects is the inability to simplify. Although invaluable, the knowledge we bring to the table may inhibit our ability to present in a simple, clear, succinct way. here are some effective ideas about explanations that are distilled from a number of neuroscience studies of explanations for impact and retention. The ones that have the highest impact and retention are the ones I'm going to mention here. And these are in your outline. This is a brief overview. And I want to just highlight them here, and then we'll incorporate them in the principles of persuasion and how to apply them. State your intentions early. This prepares an audience for an explanation and sets expectations. It's kind of coding the radar so that somebody don't know what to listen for. Don't bury the lead. State in your first sentence what problem you address and the benefits you bring. Solve a problem. To solve a problem creates effectiveness and confidence about proceeding. Keep it short. Remember the 10-10 rule that I mentioned last time from Mark Waldman's neuroscience research at Loyola Marymount, the executive MBA faculty, and his book, Words Can Change Your Brain. And the 10-10 rule, keeping a comment or an explanation to 10 words or less, has been able to reduce to 20 or 30% the amount, by 20 or 30%, the amount of time usually spent in charged situations like divorce, mediation, negotiation, arbitration. Reduce noise. Include only what is simple and relevant. Use visuals. Many people are visual learners. Visuals can capture and captivate an audience in a way that simple words can't. Match the medium and the message. In other words, a simple and goofy example is a cooking show on the radio is kind of a mismatch. Embrace imperfection. Be more concerned about substance and understanding than a too polished design and perfection. Slow down. Be timeless. Big ideas and themes have a longer shelf life and are evergreen. Be accessible and have fun. So now let's apply these. I want to talk about the 6 principles of persuasion. The persuasion appeals to deeply rooted human responses of mind and brain. Social psychology and recently neuroscience studies have identified 6 basic principles. 1, liking. We like people who like us. The application, discover real similarities, genuine connection, and offer authentic comments. Let me tell you the Magic Johnson story. When my son and daughter began playing basketball in grade school and I was coaching them, we had season tickets for the Houston Rockets, 2 seats, and they would each do a draft at the beginning of the season to pick who went to what game, and we had dinner before the game and saw the game. When the Lakers were in town, they were each excited about seeing Magic Johnson. Before the game began, I gave them each in turn a quiz and told them not to tell the other, which was no problem for them. Notice how Magic plays and see what you can pick up about what his strategy is, especially how he relates to everybody on the court. After the game, I ask each of them what they noticed. They mention how he seemed to be great friends with everybody on the court, including the other team players as well as the referees. Like, he really enjoyed the people. What else, I ask? They each mention some aspect in some way of how much he actually fouled, but he never seemed to be called for the fouls. Exactly. Everybody on the court likes him. The referees especially like him, and he genuinely seems to like them and everybody else. He was as good at working relationships as he was at ball handling, and they hardly ever called a foul on him. They participate in his success. They would be much less likely to feel that they participate in that success if they had to call a foul and disrupt the flow of that state of good energy experience with him. When people like you and sense that you have something in common, they're more likely to say yes. It's the law of attraction in action. Think about that, how this applies if you really want to get to talk with someone. You need to apply this Magic Johnson principle to the executive assistant who is the gatekeeper for that person. People essentially do business with and refer business to those who they like, know, and trust. People commit not to things, but to people who they believe really care about them. And think about it. We tend to work with and associate with and purchase things from people who share our sense of what's important, our priorities. So it becomes important to establish commonalities that aren't immediately visible by specifically addressing these values. We prefer to say yes to the request of someone we know and like. However, this simple principle is used in hundreds of ways by total strangers to get us to comply with their requests. The crucial question, what are the factors that cause one person to like another person? One is the halo effect. The halo occurs when one positive characteristic of a person dominates the way that person is viewed by others. One example is physical attractiveness. Others are talent, kindness, honesty, intelligence. Another, similarity. We like people who are similar to us. Similar backgrounds, interests, age, religion, politics. Roger Dooley, author of Brainfluence, talked about this when he was the expert content contributor at my mastermind group recently and illustrated it by pointing out how I used something I knew we had personally in common in my introduction of him. Another, compliments. The greatest car salesman in the world, Joe Girard, said that the secret of success was getting clients to like him. Each month, he sent every one of his more than 13,000 former clients a greeting card and a personal message. And the end of the message never varied. It read, "I like you." And a final one, contact and cooperation. For most part, we like things that are familiar to us. By providing people with different backgrounds, with more exposure to one another as equals, they come to like each other better. Mr. Rogers carried in his wallet a statement that said, "Frankly, there isn't anyone you couldn't learn to love once you've heard their story." We are wired to connect with others. A study in Edinburgh planted hundreds of wallets on city streets. The wallets contained one of four possible photos: a smiling baby, a cute puppy, a happy family, an elderly couple. Other wallets had no photos at all. 88% of the wallets with the baby photo were returned. 53% of the puppy photos were returned. 48% with the family photo were returned. 28% with an elderly couple were returned. Only one of seven with no photo were returned. A second factor, reciprocity. We repay in kind. The application here, give what you want to receive. People return favors. When we help people, they will want to help us. We have serious persuasive power immediately after someone thanks us. Well, of course, it's what partners do for each other, is a response. When you behave in a certain way, such as cooperatively, someone will respond in kind. Reciprocation is we try to repay in kind what the other person has provided us. There's a sense of indebtedness that the recipient experiences and wants to discharge the obligation. In a number of studies, reciprocity is so strong that it overwhelmed other factors, including a liking for the person who requested, something that normally affects the decision to comply. In one study, for example, giving the participant a Coke trumped all other factors, including liking or not liking the giver. Success in selling raffle tickets was most effective in subjects who received an earlier favor, such as receiving a Coke. The feeling that the recipient owed the giver something resulted in them buying twice as many tickets as the subjects who had not been given the prior favor. Think about the address labels you get as a gift with the request for a donation. Here's an example of reciprocity coupled with framing. One of Johnny Carson's guests on The Tonight Show was the Girl Scout who sold the most cookies that year. The young lady, Marquita Andrews, set an all-time cookie sales record in the history of Girl Scouts. What's her technique? In addition to hard work. She used a strategy to frame the customer's view of the purchase. Here's Marquita's strategy. When she knocked on the door, she would first ask for a donation to the Girl Scouts, usually $25,000 to $35,000. Well, naturally, she had no takers on that request. But then her second question, she would ask if they would at least buy a box of Girl Scout cookies. And just about everyone would. By the initial framing of the $30,000 number, she made the few bucks for some cookies seem trivial. This was last reported in Success Magazine, December 23rd, 2008. The third, social proof. We follow the lead of others. One application, use peer power whenever it's available. We do things we see other people doing, especially if those people seem similar to us or admired by us. Social proof is a way we determine what's correct, popular, and acceptable. We find out what other people think about it. We even view behavior as more correct in a given situation if we see others performing it. Like other tools of influence, it's a convenient shortcut for determining how to behave. We assume an action is more correct if others are doing it. A common example, bartenders salt tip jars with a few dollar bills at the beginning of the evening to simulate tips left by prior clients to give the impression that tipping with folding money is proper barroom behavior. In one study in San Diego, researchers hung four flyers on doorknobs. One told homeowners that they should conserve energy because it helped the environment. Another said saving energy was socially responsible. Another said it saved money. The fourth said the majority of neighbors in the community were doing it. The researchers found that the houses with the fourth flyer, the majority of neighbors in the community are doing it, showed the most change. In fact, as much as the other three combined. Simply urging people or telling them it's a good idea to recycle or conserve energy was the least effective. Another extensive study showed this contagion effect in everyday life to examine the amount of food eaten in different contexts. And think about the impact here. At restaurants, this was a large number with a survey of all kind of control variables distilled down to these simple statistics. At restaurants, on average, we eat alone the least amount, with one other person 35% more, in a party of four 75% more, in a party of seven or more 96% more. When we're unsure of ourselves and the situation is unclear or ambiguous, the greater uncertainty makes us more likely to look to and accept the actions of others as a guide for correctness. And this is the power of testimonials of previous users or clients or esteemed figures. A fourth factor, commitment and consistency. We align with clear commitment. The applications make commitments active, public, and voluntary. People want to be consistent, or at least appear to be consistent. When a commitment is voluntary and made concrete, written or publicly, people are more likely to follow through. Here's an example. A study was done by Canadian psychologists on the confidence of bettors on horses. When do you think they had the greatest confidence that the horse they chose would win? Before placing the bet, immediately after placing the bet, and immediately before the horses started racing. They were significantly more confident of their horse's chance of winning just after placing the bet. Nothing about the horse's chances shifted, but in the minds of the bettors, the prospects improved significantly once the ticket was purchased. The act of making a final decision, in this instance of buying a ticket at the racetrack, shifted to greater optimism and self-assuredness about the choice. We each have a basic desire to be and appear consistent with what we've already done. Once we make a choice, we justify and rationalize that choice. gather data to confirm it, a confirmation bias, and selectively omit data that may refute it, an inattentional blindness. We cherry-pick things that confirm and become blind to things that don't, in other words. These internal and external pressures will cause us to respond in ways that justify our earlier decision. So we make our beliefs and perceptions consistent with what we've already decided. This principle of consistency is powerful enough to direct both our perception and our action. A desire for consistency is strong enough to be a central motivator and organizer of our behavior. There are two big factors at play here. One, automatic responding in this way offers a shortcut through the confusion and the number of bits of information of our daily life. We simply don't have to expend the mental energy to weigh the pros and cons or continue making tough decisions, but resort to this default consistency. Automatic consistency is a difficult reaction to change because it offers us a way to avoid all the rigors of continuing deliberation. And secondly, we avoid the work of initiating a new action by continuing the same one. And think about how continuity programs utilize this characteristic. You give your credit card number to sign up for 3 free months of a subscription. You're charged beginning the 4th month unless you unsubscribe. 82% of people do not initiate another act of unsubscribing, but just maintain the consistency of the subscription, the status quo. 62% of those remaining subscriptions are not read, but they're not unsubscribed, because that takes a separate initiative. Automatic consistency and maintenance of the status quo functions as a shield against further thought and deliberation. For marketing, the consistency principle results in the following strategy. To obtain a large purchase, start with a small one. Findings show that almost any small sale will do, because the purchase of the initial small transaction is not a profit, but commitment. And I'm talking about a small, 99 cents for an ebook, you know, a few dollars for something that, for a white paper, something that gets someone in the pipeline where they become familiar with the value of what you do. Further purchases, including progressively larger ones, flow naturally from the commitment. This small purchase converts a prospect into a client. And the way that will not work is to start with a big purchase, like to get somebody for the first time to purchase a retreat for $5,000 or a training program for $2,500. You have to start with something very small and then go to something mid-size and then work toward the larger commitment once you've established a relationship. Now, the fifth principle of persuasion, authority. We defer to experts and those in authority. The application here, expose your expertise. Don't assume it's self-evident. When you need somebody to advance your case, your product, your service, having an agent or an advocate can also be very helpful. You're perceived as being more prestigious if someone is advocating for you. This is the authority principle in action. This is the idea behind book blurbs or endorsements from respected authorities. And finally, the sixth principle of persuasion, scarcity. We want more of what we have less of. The application, highlight unique benefits and exclusive information. People value things more when they perceive them to be scarce. G.K. Chesterton said, "The way to love anything is to realize it might be lost." Now, here's a brief illustration of this. Caitlin, my granddaughter, who was 4 at the time, was playing with a stuffed bear in her pre-kindergarten class. Sarah, her little buddy, suddenly decided that she wanted to play with the bear as well. There were a lot of other toys around, but Sarah was no longer satisfied until she had Caitlin's stuffed bear. Caitlin's mother, my daughter Lauren, a clinical psychologist, was rendered as helpless as Caitlin's absent granddad Dave in orchestrating her mastery to maintain possession of that coveted bear, or to work out a compromise for all-or-nothing four-year-old possession-oriented minds. Caitlin will later learn how her own desires will be influenced by neuromarketing techniques based on celebrity induction, social valuation, and popular trending stuffed bears. But for now, she has only impromptu strategies to wrest her bear from the evil clutches of Sarah's immediate induced desire. Both girls were in the grips of the scarcity principle. When something becomes rare or scarce, or is perceived to be, it becomes more valuable, enhancing desire. When increasing scarcity interferes with our access to something, we react by wanting to possess it even more. Later in their lives, Caitlin and Sarah will contend with marketing messages that are adult versions of the bear story. Limited number, only two left, one day remaining, we're not making any more. Mimetic desire, one person's desire mimicking that of another, is not limited to children, but plays a significant role in product adoption of best-selling goods. Our neuron system contributes to this contagion of desire. The more valued the person is, the more attention we pay to that mirroring process. Daniel Kahneman at Princeton won a Nobel Prize by showing that if you want to mobilize people under conditions of uncertainty, losing something has twice the impact than the gain of the same object or amount has in terms of pleasure. This is loss aversion. In other words, someone will feel twice as much pain in losing something as they will pleasure in gaining it. So we need to couple not just what could be gained by moving or acting or purchasing, but also what could be lost or foregone if someone does not move or purchase. The scarcity principle is that opportunities and objects seem more valuable to us when their availability is limited. The scarcity principle involves a secondary source of power. As opportunities become less available, we lose freedom and choice, and we hate to lose the freedom and choice we already have, and we desire to preserve our established prerogatives. So when increasing scarcity interferes with our access to something, we will react against the interference by wanting and trying to possess the item even more. A related tendency is to want what's been banned and to presume that it must be worthwhile when it's limited. The scarcity principle works for messages, communications, and knowledge, and that we value limited or exclusive information. An example here. When I completed my subspecialty training in psychoanalysis, I was invited to join the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Institute. I was even more excited when I was also invited to offer a continuing education course in the evening for the professional community on any subject I chose. I was warned to not be disappointed if the enrollment was low, because the highest subscription for any course that had been offered to date was 7 people. The average was 4 to 5, and occasionally courses had to be dropped because there was not enough registration or no registration. So the first thing I did when announcing the course was to stipulate that there was a maximum of 12 seats available to ensure optimum discussion. I was an optimist. I didn't know about the scarcity principle then. In the first 2 days, 14 people signed up, and the waiting list grew. I want to pause for just a minute and put us on discussion mode in case there are any questions or clarifications. We're going to talk about the science of persuasion, about why we buy in just a moment, but any questions or things so far that would be helpful for us to talk about? Or just clarifications of anything that that we've covered so far.
Yeah, David, this is Khalil. I have a question.
Yeah.
Given that we all have particular personalities and natures and characteristics, whatever, how much of who we are, and or at least who we think we are, can be adapted, modified, changed to incorporate these principles and ideas, what is required in terms of interpersonal effort to make these things ours?
Okay, you know, that's a great question, because I think that for us to be authentic is key. I think if anything that we do, we have to do from a basis of our true identity and our authenticity, or it will not work. It will show. It will be evident. Somebody will pick it up. You know, it's just like a state of mind of confidence will be immediately transferable from midbrain to midbrain, and that's how somebody confidently wants to sign on with us to work with us in mentor coaching, for example. So we have to be authentic. These are simply principles and issues that I'm highlighting that would determine how we go about something, how we go about crafting a story, how we go about connecting with someone and recognizing the things that are going to be more effective in efforts that we engage in marketing, how we can know and have a more informed empathic resonance with someone to know what's going to appeal to them first. For example, you know, no matter how much we care about helping someone or offering them a product or a service that will be a benefit to them, if we begin by talking about ourselves and talking about the benefits and the features of what we offer, it's not going to work, because we have to begin first with where they are, and where they are is what the challenges are, the experience that they have. That we have to begin with that, with the challenges or the pain points that they experience, and when we resonate with that, there's a sense that we get it, then they're together on common ground with us to listen to what are the possible solutions, what are the benefits of what we may offer. And you have to go, you have to be with somebody first before you can go someplace new. So I'm not suggesting anything that's inauthentic. I'm just suggesting a strategy that fits with and keeps into focus how our minds and brains work. Because so many of the strategies for change, so many of the strategies for doing various things, including persuasion of people, are contrary to how the mind and the brain work. So when it's compatible, it can just be more effective. Now, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, perfect. Perfect sense. Nice distinctions. Thank you.
Yeah, great question, too. Excellent. Because our authenticity, our true sense of self is what's going to show through, because that has to be there, that has to be solid and grounded, or it won't work. Any of the principles and the kinds of things that we know from science are not going to work unless it's there. Other thoughts or questions, just briefly? Okay, well let me complete this, and then we'll save some time at the end. Let's talk about the science of persuasion, specifically why we buy. People will buy your product or your service when they feel pressure. Now, this is not pressure from us. There are two kinds of pressure. External pressure from the outside, like through television or a salesperson, or internal pressure created from inside by an innate desire. Of the two, internal pressure and internal rewards are way more powerful, since people buy for their own reasons. People buy wants first and needs later. From social neuroscience, the twin forces of motivation, the two big forces that drive all human behavior, the desire to avoid pain and the desire to seek pleasure. These are the two organizing principles of the brain to minimize danger or pain and to maximize reward or pleasure. These are overarching. If we associate positive emotions or rewards, we approach. If we associate negative emotions or pain, we avoid. In fact, the brain has an innate mechanism biologically to avoid pain. If someone buys, such as signing on for your professional coaching services. They associate more pleasure to buying than not buying. If someone doesn't buy, they associate more pain to buying than not buying. And we process the pleasure and the pain cues unconsciously within a fifth of a second before we're ever consciously aware of it. So here's a master formula for persuasion: to associate buying with getting pleasure and not buying with pain. People will do more to avoid pain than to seek pleasure. Risk aversion principle, remember. Therefore, we must sell consequences, positive consequences if they do, negative consequences if they don't. We desire results brought about by gain and positive movement in our lives. We fear the pain of consequences of not doing what's needed. So much of what we do in a broad range of decisions is to prevent pain, like paying bills or doing taxes, even exercising or maintaining your house or car to avoid pain. Failure to complete any of the broad spectrum of prevent pain tasks can produce significant negative results. Doing gain tasks can produce significant positive results. This means that an important way to prioritize tasks is to look at results produced. Our brains are hardwired to prioritize survival over improvement, to prevent pain over gain, to avoid pain rather than to seek pleasure. This means that our brains are not necessarily a mechanism designed for success, fulfillment, and growth, but for survival, for the immediacy of avoiding pain or gaining pleasure. So, three steps. Remember the three building blocks of compelling stories: challenge, struggle, and resolution. These building blocks are common to all successful stories, from effective marketing to best-selling novels and film. One, the challenge. Find the problem, the pain, or the challenge. Find the deep want or the interest that's not fulfilled. What they want, but what they're not getting. What they're not able to do or be themselves. The foundation of effective selling is to highlight the continuing pain or the unmet need if they do not purchase. Second, the struggle. Find the motivations. Crystallize awareness by asking questions. And motivators are all emotional. Illuminate them by focus, by asking questions. Do you want to have the best, to be smarter, to be confident, to have the most successful practice? And three, the resolution. Show them how to solve the challenge, how to heal their discomfort by using your product. The persuasion process is of getting your client to clearly associate the most desired feeling or state with your product or service. Make it compelling and real. Associate not buying with pain. They want emotionally, but justify logically. That's exactly how we make all of our purchases. We buy emotionally and justify logically. The emotional reason, their reason to buy now, is what we have to focus on, not ours. People don't buy products, they buy states. Whatever we associate to something determines our behavior. To change behavior, change the associative link, change the state. People buy for emotional reasons and justify by logic. The most significant thing that great influencers and persuaders understand, keep in mind, and communicate is this: it's not about you, it's about them. And remember your primary question: what is it you want to accomplish through this? And this is to the client. And it's not about you, the coach, it's about them, the client. An example: when President Abraham Lincoln was a successful lawyer prior to his presidency, he began presenting a case by establishing a positive frame for him and his clients that created a distinct advantage. He would begin his opening arguments by summing up the other side's case. he would point out the positive aspects of their position, how worthy of consideration they were, and establishing his credibility by demonstrating that he recognized the other side had a legitimate view. When he then presented his client's side, he established that as well, and in detail. And he was listened to carefully because his credibility was very high. The judge and jury both concluded that if he were so willing to give credibility to the viewpoint of the other side, he must be honest in speaking from his heart. An effective way to positively and gently persuade is to win someone over by pointing out their side of the story. Discover and vocalize their point of view to show them you not only understand their point of view, but also get how it makes sense. This frame of respect and understanding of the other person's point of view will be effective in then establishing your position. Remember I said that in the beginning, you want to articulate the pain points, the challenges that someone's having. I'm exactly saying this in a different way now. So here are four primary tools of persuasion. One, relatedness. For a long-term impact, you must care about people and find a way to communicate that feeling of caring, the bilateral emotional investment and alignment of rapport. Empathy is the ability to resonate with someone else's experience, including their feelings, perspective, and ways of constructing meaning. That person's subjective reality, in other words. Our ability to effectively communicate, to influence and persuade, depends not only on our ability to empathically understand another person, but to communicate that empathy. The key is to communicate that you understand how someone feels and views a situation. If you're not exactly right, the other person appreciates that you've attempted to understand and will correct you. When someone with empathy listens and communicates that empathic understanding, the other person feels truly heard. For the other person, this is the essence of effectiveness and can at times make the difference between helplessness and hope, discouragement and determination. Integrative neuroscientists also relate this to status of being effective at a task, such as having learning and improvement recognized and acknowledged. An experience of connecting with another person releases oxytocin in the brain, further enhancing affiliation and trust. The more people trust one another, the greater the collaboration and shared information. The second tool of persuasion, autonomy, having control over the environment and the choices we make. Asking questions is our most powerful tool to persuade someone. We determine someone's focus by the questions we ask, and the way we ask the question frames the answer. When you understand what people believe and how they make decisions, you can then show them how buying your product or service is consistent with their beliefs. This is the essence of selling. Find out beliefs, discover motivations, show you care, which induces rapport and reciprocation, and determine the focus and the state. Fourth tool of persuasion, certainty. The brain is a pattern recognition machine that consistently tries to predict the near future. The act of creating a sense of certainty is rewarding. We repeat patterns. We listen to the same music. We go back to places we've seen. Change generates uncertainty. Even a small amount of uncertainty generates a response from the error detection mechanism in the orbital frontal cortex. We can increase certainty by making concepts tangible, such as how long a meeting will run, and explicit, such as the objectives. In fact, much of the field of management addresses increasing a sense of certainty at times of change and transition. Personal congruity, what you say verbally and nonverbally match. A tool of persuasion comes from feeling certain about what you're saying. And here's the important statement. The person that feels the most certain is the greatest influencer. And the fourth tool of persuasion, state management. And we're going to talk about this in all of Seminar 3, but manage your emotions and states of mind. Reset after every play. To be effective, be able to answer these three questions from the point of view of the client. What's in it for me? What is it? And then can you prove it? Then you have to answer also from the point of view of the client. Will it give me what I want and need? Will it be worth it? Will I be able to justify it? And do I need it now? So, your unique position is this. What do you do uniquely well better than anyone else? What skills do you have that people find interesting and ask you about? Be very clear. Be able to answer this in no more than one very succinct sentence. When people refer business to you, what do they tell others about you? Why do your clients continually return to you, to your products or services? What are the specific needs of your clients that your product or services will fill for them? And a final question for this seminar, what's your niche? Who do you want to persuade? And I want to look at that very briefly as we wrap up here. I want to look at that briefly from three perspectives. This is to look at what's your niche, who do you want to persuade? I want to look at three areas, avatars, ecosystems, and watering holes. And let me tell you what I mean about this and how it relates to niche. Avatars are ideal collaborators. Avatars can be defined by demographics, for example, profession, geographic area, psychological characteristics, age, gender, ethnicity, interests, age groups. Client avatars can be special interest. For example, mothers of small children, somebody who loves technology, entrepreneurs, a heavy social media user. You cannot have too specific a niche. You cannot drill down. I have never heard of anyone who's had a too specific niche. The people with the most specific, the most circumscribed niches are the ones who fill their practices first. Ecosystems now are the broad networks of avatar affiliations. Ecosystems can be defined as the specific areas, businesses, or markets frequented, the products used, or the websites utilized. So this is just another way to think about where are you going to find your clients, where are they going to gather, how do you go about thinking about this. Ecosystems can be identified by things like the nature of the business or organization, the size of the company, the type of business, the geographic area. And another final thing to think about is the watering holes, the specific locations where a large number of avatars hang out. In other words, where are you going to cross paths, literally or figuratively, with potential clients? So watering holes include blogs, forums, conferences, events, stores, LinkedIn, Facebook, networking events. Now, after all this about a niche and an ideal client, here's a practical concept. Consider your lowest hanging fruit. This is the people, the relationships you already have. People who already know you, refer to you, and will become your clients. Your existing contacts, referral sources, and gatekeepers. So here's a summary of our discussion of the neuroscience of persuasion applied to avatars, ecosystems, and watering holes. Get clear about your definition of success and how you can use it to grow your body of work. Define the specific characteristics of an idea and the connection to an avatar. Identify the ecosystem that surrounds your ideal connection avatar. Determine the watering holes where your ideal connections hang out. And practice the basics daily, especially after you're successful. True masters never stop practicing the basics. Okay, we're back to discussion mode. I'm interested in other questions or thoughts that you have, things you'd like to talk further about. Is this making sense to you and seeming practical as a way to think about crafting how you're looking at your business plan?
Dave?
Yes.
This is Abigail.
Please, go ahead.
Yes, I'm in Georgia. And it sounds very practical and lovely. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about and clarify the ecosystems. I understand that the avatars are ideal collaborators or clients. The ecosystems are where they are. Is that correct?
Exactly. These are just the systems, the locations where you're going to find people, and where you go. Where an example would be if you think about your ideal clients, and rather than going to your ideal clients one by one, to think about where are the gatekeepers of your ideal clients. If you want to work with, say, healthcare providers, for example, you may want to go to where are the gatekeepers? Could I get a mute if there's some background noise that's interfering that may be from a cell phone or a computer phone? If I could get a mute, star six, would be to go to the gatekeepers, the people who have access to a large number of people who are your ideal clients, and to have that person become a referral source to be sure that they are aware of exactly what you do and how to refer to you, that you give them feedback. If it's a situation where you can do a referral fee, that you do that. But to look at gatekeepers of people, to look at sources of gathering of people. Like if you, I was about to mention, if you do, if you work with certain healthcare providers, find out whether they, where they gather for, say, a lunch in a hospital system, and offer to do a brief presentation during one of their lunch meetings or one of their professional society meetings. To just find out, to think about where the gathering places are that that they're going to be, where you might cross paths with them, and how you might leverage your impact of influence and collaboration with them. Does it make sense?
Yeah, very much so. Thank you for clarifying.
Yeah, and always think about gatekeepers, where the people are who have access to people who would be your clients that you may not have access to, but you can do this by working with somebody who can become a referral partner. You know, another I just had someone in my the mastermind group, the group of people I do a mastermind group with, who have trained as New Life Story wellness coaches, New Money Story mentors, a woman who works out of Canada, who had an excellent way of doing this. She has a whole system of developing an internal champion. Whenever you work with a company or do a presentation to a company for work with a company, whether that's to, you know, do executive coaching or for programs or a mentor program or anything like that, to find someone in the company who you know or can develop a relationship with, and develop that relationship to develop an internal champion, so that someone already in the company has your best interest at heart, really believes in what you're doing, and can help you find ways to better position and present what you do in that company where it's their victory too. You know, like the Magic Johnson story, the referees would be his internal champions, because their success, you know, his success is their success and vice versa. They all participate in his success, and they feel that knowing him was one of the highlights of the evening and their profession, and they contributed to his success and he to theirs. So an internal champion is an example of that.
I've actually seen this in action quite recently, so thank you. Got a good picture.
Absolutely. We're out of time. If there are questions that we didn't get to, jot them down, and we'll begin right here next time. I'm really interested to hear your feedback, your thoughts, your questions. So jot it down, and we'll have some discussion time at the beginning of next seminar. So thank you very, very much. I appreciate your energy and participation. It really brings it alive. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye. Bye.